I am L.A. Lloyd, and oh, we got some great surprises for you today. Fred Meyers, promotion man, will talk about his tour with so many amazing bands going back to 1978. Also, what's in the box, and why is so much smoke coming from backstage? That's all today on Promotion Man.
Clean up on aisle two.
Clean up on aisle two this week is fairly minimal.
Yeah.
It wasn't even pickles. It was literally like a aluminum jar of olives.
More like a plastic coffee container with a few grounds on the scattered around.
Okay.
How about that?
All right. All right. So last week, we were talking about the Ramones, and we were talking about a song, and it was Needles and Pins, which actually came from the Road to Ruin album in 1978, which was the year we were talking about.
We hope if this is your first time coming to Promotion Man that you are telling your friends about it, or you've been told by some of your friends, because our little audience continues to build, including, I want to give a shout out today to my good friend Bill Nache, who is now with this Austin ATX vodka. He gave me a bottle the other day, let me sample it, and I gotta tell you, man, he's on to something there. So
So on to something. Like, was it smooth? Was it refreshing?
Well, I'll put it.
Was it effervescent?
It was. I typically drink Kettle One.
Okay.
And you know, it's a kind of a high dollar vodka.
Okay.
I would say it's as good, if not better.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, you did shoot me a photo of the bottle. The bottle looked awesome.
Yeah, and so I understand you've been doing a little drinking over the 4th of July recently too there.
Yeah.
What were you dabbling in?
Well, I'm a bourbon guy. I'm a bourbon or a whiskey guy, and I happened to be invited to a party where Ben Milam had, they were serving Ben Milam bourbon and whiskey.
Right.
And I put it on the rocks. And it was very good. It was really, really good. Surprisingly, delicious.
Wow.
Yeah. So, Warner Brothers, this was like my fifth or sixth week to be a employee. And one of the things that I enjoyed about being with Warner Brothers and my job was just how great the artists were. I mean, there's just no question that Warner Brothers was an artist-driven company. Starting with the Grateful Dead as one of the first rock bands that they had signed. So, you know, it was just an amazing opportunity to be with some of these bands that, you know, to this day just have set a different tone and message that is like no other. And another thing that was fun about being with Warner Brothers was we would get this box every week. And in this box would be our tracking sheets that we had talked about.
Right.
And then there'd be bios of certain bands that we had just signed that, you know, the releases are coming up. And we always got advances on the releases. So we would get things way ahead of release date. And I say way ahead, like 2 to 3 months in advance. So we would get them, like I said before, where it would be a label with no writing and just typewritten piece of paper. But they would come in this box. And along with that, you'd either get a very hip t-shirt of something.
Yeah.
Or you'd get these enamel, very hip enamel rock and roll buttons. Like one, I have a bunch of them, but one of them is Bugs Bunny dressed like the Ramones in a black leather jacket and blue jeans. And he's, you know, it's Bugs Bunny, you know.
Do you still have this?
Yeah. And so what was really great about these was when I first started, I got a phone call from a lady in Burbank. And she said, Fred, you know, I want to welcome you to the company and all of that. And she said, I need to get your sizes. So what size do you take in a shirt?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what size is your waist?
Right.
You know, what's your shoe size? And then she even asked for my sleeve size. And of course, I'm tall. So it was actually kind of cool because I got the coveted Warner Brother varsity jacket.
Oh, cool.
Which everybody loved this because it was just like having a high school jacket.
Right.
But instead of your high school logo, it was the Bugs Bunny popping out of the Warner Brothers symbol.
Wow.
And it was your official Warner Brother Records varsity jacket.
Yeah.
And I couldn't wait because on my first day on the job, blitzing the Van Halen album, Mike Diamond had his on.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't wait to get mine. And so all of a sudden, here it comes, you know, and you pull it out of the box and there it is. And you put it on and it fits perfectly. And it was just so cool. And then remember when
we used to get satin tour jackets.
Oh, yeah.
So satin was a big deal. So we had a bunch of, you know, so I had so many like tour jackets of different bands.
And where are they now?
And where are they now? I mean, where are they now? Like the original Van Halen logo, you know, on a black T-shirt.
Oh, my God.
You know, Warner Brothers put that out way before they were available to buy as a consumer.
Right.
So I still, if there's one thing I really loved was every week we would get that box.
Yeah.
And you never knew, like, what cool little item is going to be in there now.
That's awesome. That's a good story.
Yeah. We're following my tour of 1978, and we had ended last week with the Ramones, and then coming up is my experience with Bob Marley and the Wailers.
Oh, wow. I've been waiting for this one.
But before I get there, I want to talk about Little Feat, because what happened is Bob Marley and the Wailers kicked off their tour in Ann Arbor, right, and it was their opening night. And then right after that show, I had Little Feat for two dates. So I want to kind of talk about Little Feat first.
So what is what was the song that was kind of popular by Little Feat during this time?
Dixie Chicken Dixie was Chicken, a really yeah. big one. A Red Stream Liner.
Right.
There was a lot of really great tracks. But what I wanted to say is that out of all the bands that Warner Brothers had, and Warner's had an amazing stable of bands, this was the band that I think was the house band. This Wow. was the band that I think everybody from the top of the company all the way down just loved this band.
So what were they classified as? I mean, they weren't really rock. They weren't really a jam band, because jam bands weren't really a thing at the time, except for the Dead maybe. But I mean, what did you guys kind of put them in a category of?
Well, remember when we were talking about Southern rock, or not Southern rock, California rock.
Right, right.
Because we were discussing Elektra Asylum Records and their artists. Well, these guys were all out of Los Angeles, mm-hmm. and yet they had a rock boogie kind of thing going on, and they were just incredible. And when you'd see them live, they would, when they were on, they were so on. I mean, they would just rip.
Yeah.
And Lowell George was an incredible front man and lead singer, but every single player in that band was just amazing.
Yeah.
So I've got them at this little auditorium in Michigan called the Royal Oak Theater. Mm-hmm. So they were touring on the double live album Waiting on Columbus. Mm-hmm. And that album, I think, really signifies the power of that band. And to this day, I listen to that on a regular basis, where we all have these certain albums we will put on at home because we somehow gravitate to Exile on Main Street or whatever it might be.
Right.
This Waiting on Columbus is one of those that is in my probably top 20 that I'll still listen to on a regular basis.
Nice.
And it made me flash back to like 1965, wow. because one of my favorite all-time movies was Hard Day's Night by the Beatles.
Okay.
So when I'm 9, my mom wants to get me out of the house, and for a quarter, she can like hook me into a matinee with a buddy and yeah. drop us off, and I'll be out of her hair for a couple hours.
Right.
And so it was a Hard Day's Night was playing at the Royal Oak Music Theater. So it was like a quarter, 35 cents, something like that. And it was such an amazing movie, and it's the Beatles.
Yeah.
So my friend, Donald Lamb, my neighbor, him and I never left. Oh. So every time the movie would end, we would go call our parents and say, we want to stay. And they're like, go ahead, stay.
Right.
So we got there at the matinee, which was like 10:30 in the morning, and we didn't leave the theater till 10 o'clock at night.
Holy cow.
So I think I watched the movie like maybe 5 or 6 times like in a row.
And the ushers never saw you.
No, they didn't pay attention.
That's great, man.
But what happened is that was where rock and roll became my world.
You saw it there.
So much so that I put a band together and we had tennis rackets is what we would play or pretend to play in my parents' garage.
Yeah.
And I was really pretty good at it.
Yeah.
You know, kept it in tune.
Yeah. Wound the strings pretty tight.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, so now I'm in the exact same theater with Little Feat.
Oh, wow.
And I'm backstage, and here's the thing about contest winners. we never really card them. We never really say, okay, how old are you or anything like that. So I'm backstage and I look over and Lowell George has got a line out of an illegal substance.
Right.
And here's the contest winner and him. And I'm going, wait, stop, stop. And I grabbed.
That's rules back here, man.
And I grabbed this kid and Lowell's like, what? This is rock and roll.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, but no. But that's kind of a common theme here because when I get with Bob Marley and the Wailers, they're opening up in Ann Arbor and they're kicking off their Kaya tour. Because it was the very first show, there wasn't really anything to do with the band and I wasn't even allowed to go say hello to them, which is usually part of our job. This was in April. So I was with Michael Franks, who was really pretty unique, and he had a big hit called Popsicle Toes.
Right.
And then 2 days later, I was with Al Jarreau, who was also part of the Warner Jazz series. And he was pretty incredible.
So right there, that just kind of shows you the diversity that you had to deal with. Like you said, from Little Feat to Al Jarreau to, you know,
Michael Franks.
I mean, it shows you that you had to wear a lot of different hats.
Yeah, I did. And this is just, so I started March 6th, so we're in April.
Right.
You know, and so now, May 9th, I've got two dates with Alice Cooper, but he's coming off of his tour, so his management kind of shut down all media visits.
So all this was in within about a month's time frame.
You've got
Al Jarreau, Alice Cooper, Michael Franks, Bob Marley, who
else? So
and
like
Little Feat, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So all of a sudden, May 18th, 1978, at the Hill Auditorium is the opening show for the North American tour for Bob Marley and the Wailers.
Right.
And I think Exodus was the album that really built the momentum that was set up by albums like Catch a Fire or Burning or Natty Dread. And then, of course, the 1976 release of Rastaman Vibration. So Bob was finally getting some of the airplay, you know, he deserved for Jamming and Three Little Birds and One Love. So the Kaya tour was really the tour where people started to come out in earnest to kind of see what was all the commotion about.
Yeah.
What is this reggae? What is this Bob Marley and the Wailers thing? What is this?
Were they getting a lot of airplay at this point or just starting to get some radio airplay?
Just starting and you know, it was more college and it was more word of mouth. I think if anything built reggae in America, it was word of mouth.
Yeah.
And the album or the fact that that tour was really at that level, it was even Island Records actually released Babylon by Bus later in the year. And it was a live album from these concerts. And, you know, these are some pretty magical shows.
Right.
The band was extremely tight. And to be honest, it felt like a village because there was like must have been 20 plus people in this
the
group.
Early meaning of I've got my posse.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, there was the background singers. There's the guys playing congos. There's the band themselves and the keyboard. And I mean, it was just a huge setup. But what was cool for me is that I had no responsibilities whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm super new. And so I was just in the middle of the crowd like everybody else. The house lights go down and all of a sudden the stage light go up and all of a sudden here comes Positive Vibration. And it just immediately grabbed everybody in this small college town all at one time. And it was extremely magical.
So how big was, you know, like I said, I have to do a little homework on, you know, how big reggae was pre-Bob Marley. But was there reggae at all? I mean, obviously, like you said, there's some small fringe artists, but he definitely is known as the reggae guy who really brought it out to the masses.
He's the one that brought it out to the masses. So, you know, this kind of brings me to Warner Brothers and back to Warner Brothers and the labels they worked with. You know, Warner Brothers was pretty smart because they would look at independent record labels and they would look at what they had going and they'd say, look, you know, why don't we strike a deal with you guys if you're up for it and let us finance you and have half ownership. And then all of a sudden you'll get our distribution, our promotion and the muscle behind, you know, the WIA so that your artists will get a much better opportunity. So what Warner Brothers did
is they had deals with Sire Records, mm-hmm. who had the Ramones, the Talking Heads, the Tough Darts. You know, they went on to sign the Pretenders, Depeche Mode, Madness, Soft Cell.
Yeah.
You know, I'll Melt With You. You still hear that song all the time. I mean, there's so many Soft Cell
songs. That's modern English.
Clean Up on Aisle 2.
No.
Yeah. I Melt With You is modern English.
I have to, I think you.
Soft Cell did Tainted Love.
Soft Cell did Tainted Love, that's for sure. So they had that, and then they went on to sign Madonna and Seal.
Yeah.
And I have a good friend of mine that we're going to have on the show as a guest, because he was instrumental when they signed the Talking Heads, the Pretenders, and Madonna.
Wow.
So we're going to have him on the show. Then they had Island Records, and Island had Bob Marley and the Wailers. They had Robert Palmer, who we talked about last week.
Right.
They had Steve Winwood. They had the Buggles, Toots and the Maytals. So if you talk about another reggae band.
Right.
And then they went on to sign a little band called U2 out of Ireland. We had Bearsville out of upstate New York that somehow had signed Foghat, which were basically, well, they were a mix of Americans and guys out of England.
Yeah.
They had Todd Rundgren on that label. They had Jesse Winchester. And then ECM Records, which is a German label that had this amazing jazz. Pat Metheny, Keith Jarrett, Jack DeJohnette, and more. And then, of course, we talked about Reprise Records that had Frank Sinatra. Well, we also, when we signed Neil Young, he was on Reprise, and he refused to be moved over to Warner Brothers.
Really?
Yeah, because we had tried to move him over to Warner Brothers and just kind of put the Reprise label on hold.
Yeah.
And he said no.
So amazing to have Frank Sinatra and Neil Young on the same label when you really think about it.
I know.
I mean, that's so amazing.
So, was there other reggae bands? Yes, there definitely were, but I think Bob Marley and the Wailers were the ones that really kind of popped through the ceiling, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
The Detroit show was a few days after the Ann Arbor show, and that's where Little Feet were kind of in the middle there.
Right.
At the Royal Oak Theater. So now I have Bob Marley and the Wailers in the Masonic Temple in Detroit, which is just a few thousand people.
Now, this is a real Masonic temple.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So it's really kind of ornate and just beautiful, actually. Right. You go in there and it's unbelievable. And I mean, I've seen Bruce Springsteen there. So many bands would play there, because I think when the promoters were booking these bands, they were looking for the right arena that would sell enough tickets to make it worth their while. But also, you know, if you can get into a couple thousand, it's a money-making venture for both the band and the promoter.
So how big are we talking here, like if you maxed it to capacity?
I think probably maybe 2,500.
Wow.
You know, or 2,000.
It's a very intimate show to see Bob Marley and the Wailers.
Yeah.
And packed.
Yeah, and every city, I think, has this venue that would have plays and ballets and operas, and you've got the upper deck. You know, but still intimate, still small enough to where you actually are connected to the show.
Yeah.
So Detroit, as we have talked about, was a very important market. And the promotion department had a special dinner set up with Bob Marley. And what we did is we invited all the important people from radio, from records, from press. And so the dinner was set up at a downtown hotel, and it was a huge success. And I remember one of my bosses, he was from our branch where we distributed out of Cleveland. He had come in for the show. So when we went to the backstage, I actually got a chance to meet Bob Marley in person and shake his hand.
Wow.
Yeah, I wish I would have gotten a picture.
That would have been amazing.
But Warner's was really kind of downplaying that. They didn't want you to be a fan.
Right.
You had a job to do. So they really downplayed pictures, you know, unless it was in a scenario that warranted that.
So before this dinner, I mean, all the suits, if you will, that came in for that, I mean, were they all aware of what reggae was and what Bob Marley was all about and the movement? And, you know, I mean, because that was a real big movement with his music, you know?
Well, that's just it. You could feel it. You could feel it. And that's why the Kaya tour was selling out rapidly. And even though the album that they were touring behind never really gained that much success,
It was the Babylon by Bus live album that we ended up releasing right before Christmas, you know, that in 1978
right.
to go capture that Christmas dollar.
Yeah.
But it was the whole movement itself. And remember, you're playing on a global scale. So just like trying to establish punk rock with the Ramones and touring them in Europe.
Yeah.
Bob was doing a lot of touring in Europe, and he was really big there. And it was actually, he was bigger there than America, but it started to cross the pond, if you will.
Right.
I get a chance to meet him, which was amazing. It was like, you know, one of the highlights of my life for a kid from Detroit to experience one of these opportunities to, you know, to meet this man. And truthfully, he wasn't as iconic then as he's become today.
Right.
You know, I was looking up Facebook pages of official Facebook pages for bands.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Marley's Facebook page has 66 million followers.
Wow.
66 million.
Take that in. That, you talk about a legacy and a legend, man. I mean, it's like
that. I mean, I looked up a bunch of bands that I had worked with, and like, you know, Fleetwood Mac at 4.9, ZZ Top at 4.7.
Wow.
U2 have 16 million.
Holy cow. And they've got 67.
Yes.
Bob Marley.
Yeah.
Wow. Powerful, man.
So all of a sudden, Al, who's older, I'm like 22 and Al's probably in his mid 40s. He's getting nervous because we're there early. The place is starting to let people in. And the band, or if we should call them the Village,
right.
are smoking so much ganja. And Al's getting nervous. And, you know, it's an illegal substance.
Yeah.
And Al starts, his mind starts playing with him. And he's like, well, what if they arrest one of the members?
Yeah.
This is, you know, what if they, you know, arrest Bob himself? And the reason we get worried is because we've all dealt with these security guards that when they're given a badge or a uniform, they have this power that, A, they really shouldn't have. But then you give it to the wrong person and they can become such a dickhead.
Oh, yeah.
And I've had all the credentials I could possibly have to be where I need to be, whether it's backstage or on the stage or whatever. And they still give you a hard time.
Right.
So he starts thinking, well, what if one of these dumbasses decides to really push the envelope and go after, you know, somebody in the band, because the smoke started to, first of all, it's thick and it's coming from the back of the stage.
Right. There's no doubt where the smoke's coming from.
And I'm kind of going, well, we don't even have a group of four or five guys here. We have a village. So I don't even know how to accomplish, like, to go tell them not to do this.
Right.
Because in their culture, it's like drinking water or breathing air. It's part of their culture.
Yeah.
So the more it's happening, you know, and you can smell it and you can see the smoke and you know where it's coming from. The more it's going on, the more he's getting like really out of whack. So I said, all right, let's figure out what we're going to do here. And I noticed that there's these oscillating fans and I can see them kind of pushed against the back walls of the backstage. And I said, Al, why don't you go to the left side and pull that fan? And, you know, and it was standing up, you know, so it was tall. And they're heavy and they have wheels and you just move them around. So I said, go get yours and put it behind the curtains and push, you know, facing the band and plug it in. I'll go take care of the right side. And we did.
Yeah.
And we plugged them in and it literally did exactly what we needed it to
do. So it blew the smoke
back towards the band.
Ah, gotcha.
Because our goal was to just keep it off of the security people's radar and it worked. And then all of a sudden, you know, here comes the house lights go down.
Yeah.
And of course, now everybody probably brought their own joint to light up. So it doesn't matter. But in that crucial moment, you know, he was thinking, oh my God, we are not going to be the ones with Warner Brothers who gets our premier artist arrested and deported or whatever because they're smoking pot. So
I wonder if they ever got arrested on that tour or any other tours down the road. I mean, because there had to be in one city that's, like you said, there's going to be that one dickbag security guard that's going to go up on stage and try to pop somebody.
Yeah. You know, it's hard to say, and you always have that dickhead security guard. You always do. But as far as the band goes and the music, I have to tell you, they were incredible. And Bob, as an artist and a guitar player, I mean, he had his Les Paul and he's got it. He's got that magic. He brings that magic with him. It's almost like he has this aura or energy around him. And the band clearly feeds off of it. And it was a magical night, Lloyd. I got to tell you, I mean, the house lights went down. They went right into positive vibration. And it's just awe-inspiring because they are all in sync. And they're all incredibly talented. And out of all the bands I've seen, and I've seen some pretty amazing shows, I was lucky enough to see the Pink Floyd Dark Side of the Moon tour.
Wow.
You know, and that's right up there with like one of my best shows I've ever seen in my entire life. And I've seen a bunch.
How was Bob as a band leader? I mean, like, you know, because when you think of reggae, it just seems so laid back and so spontaneous and off the cuff. I mean, it sounds to me like they were a well-oiled machine, very tight. And just as a band leader and the front man, was he kind of like a prince who really knew where everybody needed to be and have their places? Or was it more just laid back like I was talking?
No, it was actually, he definitely was the leader of the band. Not only did he, you know, continually check in with everybody, but the fact that, like I had said, he had this aura, he had this energy. You know, if you've ever been on a stage where you're with these bands and they're creating this magic, you know, it makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck because when they're on, like I said, they are on.
Yeah.
And there's something going down there that's on another dimension. And that happened to be the height of it, I think, for him because he ended up dying of cancer not too long, you know, a couple years after this.
Right. Very young.
Yeah, in his 30s. And I mean, and he was in his, and so this tour was pretty amazing. And again, I was extremely blessed to not only have a chance to actually meet him in person, but witness the very first show. And then a few days later, you know, the Detroit show. And it was a lot of fun.
And the Wailers still continue to this day. I mean, they're always touring. And I know even here in Austin where the show's based at, I mean, we still have reggae festivals that they'll play frequently. So, I mean, it's great to see that his music is carrying on. But again, it's not the same without having the man there.
You know, it's funny that things do carry on because at Virgin Records, we had Ziggy Marley.
Right.
So I actually had an opportunity to work with his son, Ziggy Marley.
Right. I forgot about that.
When he was at Virgin Records. And again, like we talked about seeing Ramones t-shirts when you travel the world. You know, travel the world, you're going to see a Bob Marley t-shirt for sure.
Absolutely.
I mean, everywhere. So, again, thank you guys for listening. We have more bands to talk about, and each week it'll be more and more fun. But this one was a great one. I couldn't wait to tell you this Bob Marley story. Again, tell your friends about the podcast and help us get this podcast out there. And again, thanks for listening.
Promotion Man, the true backstories of the most iconic bands in the world, told by Fred Myers and interviewed by me, L.A. Lloyd. Get involved and interact on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You'll find the links at promotion-man.com. That's promotion-man.com. Download the weekly Promotion Man podcast on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Google Play, or your favorite podcast provider. We appreciate you subscribing and spreading the word, and thanks for listening.